Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined today by Ian Smith, Companies Editor. How are you doing, Ian?
Not too bad, John. How are you?
Very good, thank you. Bradley Gerard, how are you, Bradley?
I'm good. It's been a busy week.
Yes, isn't it? Yes, lots of results. Lots and lots of results.
Plus the autumn statement.
And the autumn statement. The last autumn statement.
The last autumn statement to be replaced by an autumn budget and a spring statement.
Yeah, I think it made sense, but you wouldn't have thought so at the time. We all listened to this in the office, of course, it being an important fiscal event. And there was much laughing and jeering, as there always is in Parliament, but more so than usual. But actually, I think it makes sense, and I'm sure we'll come on to the autumn budget very shortly, because it forms a big part of the news section this week. So we are unfortunately not able to be joined by Alex Newman, who's written the cover feature about Amazon, because he's in Spain, isn't he?
Yeah, he's on a site visit to one of the resources companies that he covers.
Yeah, he's going to see one of the oldest mines in Europe, called Rio Tinto, near Seville. Famous mine.
Famous mine. That's one of my top five.
One of your top five mines.
Separate podcast.
Unfortunately, Alex is not able to be here. We can kind of fill in some of the blanks around the feature, because I think it will undoubtedly come across in some of the results we discuss very shortly.
Definitely, and Amazon as a topic and as a disruptive force is one that we've talked about a fair amount on this podcast. But what's really great about the feature, together with Harriet and Theron, it is that you really get a sense of the risks attached to other stocks that are exposed to Amazon. There's a great table in the piece where Alex and Harriet and Theron try and grade the impact that Amazon might have on some of the different sectors.
Indeed, and you know, it kind of does beg the question, which Alex also tries to answer, is whether, you know, if you could invest in one stock and one stock only, should that stock be Amazon? And you know, there is a strong case for actually that being the case. Let's come on to that in a minute. Let's start with the news this week. Autumn statement in a minute. What else we got, Bradley?
An interesting little stat that the FT picked up on through a bit of analysis was the fact that four of the most watched of indices in the US all touched a record high this week, which has only happened, the last time it happened was in 1999.
I think 1999, yeah. I remember it well. It all turned out so brilliantly after
party
that.
Like it's 1999. So, yeah, I mean, it's just an interesting stat. I mean, what one could argue, it doesn't mean very much, but it's just interesting that there's that much bullishness around, or you can perceived bullishness, in spite of what's been a tumultuous year in terms of politics and that sort of thing. Obviously, with the EU referendum vote, Mr. Trump's election to the highest office in the land. Not our land, obviously, the land over the pond. But
the highest office in the world, you could argue.
Arguably.
I mean, this is not what people predicted was going to happen if Trump were to be elected. We wanted the status quo candidate. We wanted Hillary Clinton, who would make sure, you know, business as usual was the order of the day. Stock markets could carry on their merry dance and everything would be okay. But actually, stock markets have arguably responded better. I mean, we don't know for sure, but I can't imagine the response to a Hillary victory would have been the same.
No, I guess, there are so many reasons why the stock market could rise. It could be that people see Trump as more of a risk and might seem odd, but because of that, that could be good for stocks. It might mean the central bank might do more stimulus or not move on rates or whatever.
But but that's kind of the opposite narrative that we're also getting, certainly when we look at the bond market, that actually we think that this will encourage the central banks to actually start pushing up rates.
And I actually covered this in my column last week, and I think that's a reason why to expect the equity market to factor in all of the risks of a Trump presidency is just far too much. And the assumption running up to the vote that a Trump victory would be bad for markets, I just didn't really see the reason why that was, especially given that he is looking at cutting taxes across a range of income, investments, inheritance, and business taxes, importantly. And also he's talking about infrastructure investment that could help business. So the idea that a candidate comes in that will cut tax will be very bad for the economy straight away didn't really make sense. I do understand it when it comes to the trade deals. He could act unilaterally to affect, as we've talked about in this podcast before, some of the trade deals that America has and the ones it's writing, as he's already done since the vote. But the idea that Trump would be a net bad for the equity market wasn't quite clear. So yeah, to Bradley's point, perhaps you've had a relief rally, but I think it reduces the uncertainty. Was my argument is that prior to the election, the uncertainty was you had one of these two people with a range of policies, and after the election, you just have one person and what they can get through the legislature. Mm. So I really think, you know, in some ways you could argue that uncertainty has come down a bit, maybe a contrarian view.
Because he's a very predictable guy, is Donald Trump.
Are they?
He might not be, but I guess there's a certain element of predictability within the, as Ian said, the legislature. Like, yes, the president can potentially do what he or she wants, but there are, as has been talked about before, the safeguards of it being having to go through, you know, two houses of,
yeah. So, but you know, one of the things he's talking about that everyone's got very excited about is this massive infrastructure splurge, and we're hearing much the same thing here in the UK. Some of that was within the Autumn Statement. I mean, not a splurge on the scale that potentially they're talking about in the US, but some spending nevertheless that's going to cost a lot of money. But you know, I think we're perhaps oversimplifying the reaction or the likelihood of what's going to happen. Yeah, this is my worry about markets sometimes. They've oversimplified the kind of cause effect. The narrative is, yes, loads of money spent on infrastructure, good news for all. And I just worry that we've kind of run ahead of ourselves again here.
Well, that's partly why I found the stats so interesting, because it you know, a lot of people who maybe watch markets very closely, analyze a lot of data, might well see this as a sign of, you know, a real peak in markets.
And irrational exuberance,
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, exactly. So it was very interesting anyway.
Yeah, no, it really is. We'll be watching it closely. I mean, this does have implications for a number of UK listed stocks who are involved in the construction, and particularly infrastructure construction space.
What we can say is that political rhetoric has moved from fiscal conservatism to more spending on infrastructure. Whether that comes through in a huge amount of projects is another matter. And I think one thing that's very important in the UK is that some of the major infrastructure projects require a fair amount of political decision making and some quite tough decisions to actually happen. And we all know the major projects that are out there. And obviously we've had a decision about Heathrow, albeit that's still going to take a while. But there are other areas where we need to then see the decisions. It's all very well to talk about money. There's also a lot of institutional money that's prepared to go into infrastructure, but you need the projects, and that's what any investor would say.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, an interesting project that was recently given the go-ahead in the UK is obviously Hinkley Point. Now, that has the go-ahead, you know, in all respects. I mean, I guess it's shovel-ready, as they would call it. But there's another project.
But the government, even on that, the government flip-flop about it. You know, the new Theresa May government coming in, wasn't sure about the Chinese involvement. It's a good example of actually something that was pretty much ready to go under David Cameron's administration. And then the new government came in and looked like maybe they were going to introduce a stumbling block, then took away that stumbling block. But if that's going to be the path of future policy over infrastructure, that there's going to be that kind of horse trading ahead of it, that doesn't bode well for a series of quick decisions.
Well, I would say that that was quite a sensible approach to that particular project, because it is big and it is contentious, and you know, it is a new government, and I think they quite sensibly, they didn't take that long to reach a conclusion in the grand scheme of political thinking and infrastructure projects. I also think it was contingent upon what was going to happen at other nuclear potential sites in the UK, one of which is near my house, Bradwell, and they were given, as far as I understand, the Chinese were given assurances that that's going to happen still. I tell you what, they've got to get that through planning. So, you know, and this brings up the whole issue that you can have all these wonderful infrastructure ideas, but actually, particularly in the UK, NIMBYism is a very strong force.
Yeah, it is. And I guess one of the sort of key numbers kind of come out, or one of the key points to come out of the Autumn Statement, was this sort of new investment fund, as he called it, to kind of help promote growth and help promote productivity and that type of thing.
I have to say, Bradley, before you go on, I felt that here's £400 million. This is going to, I don't even know if that was the figure. I think it's irrelevant. This is how we're going to improve productivity. Productivity and money are not, like, one is not the answer for the other. I don't quite understand how chucking money at something is going to improve productivity.
I mean, he was talking about, I guess, his hope and his idea is on a tangible level to improve things like transport networks and roads so people can get to work more quickly and therefore work potentially more efficiently because they'll be at work more focused for fewer hours, that sort of thing.
I'll get my best work done on the train.
Well, maybe your train journey will be better because you're always moaning about that.
It takes a long time. I get a lot of work done.
And things like, you know, faster broadband, there are an incredible now number of self-employed people, many of whom may well be working from home, who do not have the speed of internet they need to conduct their business properly. Things like that could improve productivity. So you're right, improving productivity via money is not necessarily a linkage, but there are things that he is trying to, Philip Hammond is trying to target to improve to help productivity rise, whether it will happen, of course.
We jumped straight into the autumn statement, even though we said we were going to talk about other stuff first. But hey, whatever. I mean, yeah. So we covered the broadband piece online.
So CityFibre is a really interesting company that does lays fibre broadband networks to businesses and consumers kind of around the regions. And that company saw its share price rise quite strongly on the day. And I suppose, in addition to what you're saying, there's the promised investment that BT Openreach is going to make in the network too. But it's so important. I saw this statement from Redrow, the house builder, saying that when they did a survey of their potential customers, that broadband connectivity was the most important amenity they thought about when buying a house, which I suppose you would say that's pretty straightforwardly true, but that's over shops, you know, that people were given the option to. So it's so key. All these things linked together with the autumn statement, the house builders, the broadband connectivity, the infrastructure to boost the productivity.
But is that really what makes Germany so much more efficient? You know, is output that so much, you know, better? I think it's something like 20%, 25% better than UK. But is it really down to good broadband connections? Is there something more, something fundamental going on in the way businesses are run?
Maybe, but I do think you can be too reductive in just saying it's just broadband. I think the infrastructure point is important. If you look at the major productivity gains historically in like the US and the UK, it's been related to big advances in the infrastructure, allowing businesses, electrification of businesses, allowing people to fly from place to place. And just someone who lives in East London and is waiting for another bridge across the Thames, you see how much time is wasted by businesses in terms of getting around our small country.
What do you need to go to South London for?
You know, it's a lot on the other side of the Thames, John.
Actually, I say that. We are in South London. This is as far as I get in South London, I must admit. I get the point.
We've got the mayor of South London, actually, in the booth. Dom, the mayor of SE1.
That is correct.
Self-appointed.
So you've got the King of Essex in the studio.
Royalty.
Anyway, listen, it's interesting. I'm not sure. These sound like marginal gains to me rather than like massive.
We won
increases.
The Olympic cycling with marginal gains.
Okay, yeah, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, well done. Well, maybe Dave Brailsford should be Prime Minister.
I mean, you're
right. That's not a bad idea.
You're right. It is incremental, and I think Philip Hammond had little space to move, really, though he has done a bit. You know, he's created a bit more spending headroom, albeit he's going to borrow more to do it. But I don't know. I mean, at least the things, in a way, you say it's not a huge big thing. Maybe that's positive. Maybe smaller things that seem more achievable might be achieved rather than us talking about big grand scale things that Heathrow, HS2 just get bogged down in political Britback and just don't come to fruition.
I like the philosophical optimism there.
Well, I think, John, where I agree with you is that I don't think the announcements made really turn the dial in terms of infrastructure. And I think that the rising cost of borrowing with gilt yields on an upward path.
That's another matter altogether.
It's another matter altogether.
A lot.
And what newspapers have really stressed, I think rightly, is the scale to which the public finances are in a worse state than under George Osborne. I don't want to get it's all political about it in terms of the factors there. But the reality of that, if you're thinking we're going to borrow a lot more to invest in infrastructure, I think it was quite difficult for Philip Hammond as the new Chancellor to announce an absolutely huge infrastructure spending, you know, the likes of FDR's New Deal in terms of, you know, the amount that was built. It didn't on the day result in any really material share price changes amongst any of the companies that were exposed to these sectors, which is very much different from the impact that we've seen in the US.
Yeah, I mean, there was a certain section of the market that did suffer a bit of an impact from Philip Hammond's autumn statement. And before we go on, I think it was quite a sensible statement. I think he did a good job, quite frankly, under the circumstances, which you would not perhaps believe if you read the diatribes of negative commentary elsewhere. I thought he did a good job. Well done, Philip, and you made some good jokes, even though apparently he hadn't previously made a joke since 1978. However, one sector did get hammered, and it was the property sector.
This had been leaked, I guess, that there would be a ban on letting agent fees or fees that they charge to tenants. The comments after the announcement were kind of to the effect that, you know, it's almost like a balloon. Like if you squeeze one end of it, then another end will get fatter. So the letting agents are going to find the money they need to cover the cost of doing things like credit checks from somebody. And the chances are it will now be the landlord rather than the tenant.
So this is the policy to ban letting agency fees.
Yeah, on tenants.
On tenants.
Yeah.
I haven't let a property for a long time. So I
rented
even, so imagine, haven't let one either.
So imagine any kind of fee that you can make up as a letting agent CEO and then just levy that on a tenant. It's very easy. You can charge a fee for anything, counting the amount of forks in the drawer. You can really charge anything because you have a customer that has to deal with you because they want to rent a flat, and you can charge them anything. And as Bradley says, a lot of
it really got that bad? Well, I haven't rented. I haven't rented a property since 2001, and I don't remember it being that bad. The levies imposed. I mean, they always tried to nick your deposit. But Dom, over in the control room, you're a frequent rental mover.
Yes, I am.
Tell me about it.
Yeah, it's awful. They charge you quite literally, as Ian said, for anything. Yeah, we are ready to move, and we have stayed with the same landlords because I can't bring myself to pay all these extra fees. We've just moved into one of their other properties.
So this policy that Philip Hammond has introduced was kind of dismissed by many as kind of tinkering and, you know, a bit of a showboating, but really wouldn't amount to much. But it sounds like you would disagree with that, though.
Yes. I'm concerned that those fees that the tenant no longer pays will just be put onto the rent.
That is the most cogent criticism of it, that it passes straight in terms of extra rental charges to the tenant as the changes to stamp duty and the other changes to tax relief that we've seen on landlords. That's a classic argument against it. It's also a good reason never to do anything against landlords. But I would disagree with that to an extent. So the letting agent that is dealing with the tenant will add on loads of fees because they know they can fleece the tenant as much as they wish. If we're talking about the worst practices, and there's lots of good letting agents out there.
And lots of good landlords as well.
And lots of good landlords.
Many of whom are our readers.
Exactly. Lots of good landlords as well. And this is a policy that's designed, I think, at the worst practices in the market. Now, if you say, okay, well, they'll pass that straight on to the landlord. But if you're a letting agent, the landlord is a client that can go elsewhere to other letting agents. Yeah. So the idea that you will charge the same extortionate fees, if you happen to be charging extortionate fees, on your landlord client as you would charge on a tenant, I don't think is very rational. And I think we've seen that now in a couple of the company pronouncements, haven't we, Bradley, today?
Yeah, I mean, on the announcement, the share
I'm extrapolating from those.
No, you're right, though. I mean, on during the autumn statement, things like Foxton's share price in particular was getting a bit of a hammering. So this morning we had something like from Belvoir and Purple Bricks, and Belvoir were talking about a potential 8% hit to gross profits.
From the letting agency fees.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, wow. This is an estimate based on potentially a moving target, because the thing we're talking about is a proposal. It's generally believed that this will happen. Maybe there'll be a sort of a slight lightening of it, but there is a belief it will happen. But yeah, so obviously already the letting agents are starting to try and quantify the potential impact of this.
And they've said, to be fair to them, you know, up to 8%, haven't they?
Yeah.
In terms of it might be less. But obviously they're doing the sums on, okay, how much of these fees do we charge? Pretty simple calculation. Then how much
8% entire revenue?
I don't think it's that simple. I think it's how much do we charge and how much can we pass on to the landlords instead? Because some things do need to be paid for. And then the difference, I would say, is probably 8% of gross profits, up to 8% of gross profits. So I don't completely buy the argument that it all just passes on in rent. But at the same time, that is definitely an easy route,
basically. As you say, the market could function. And that market is, as you say, landlords going, well, that sounds a bit steep. I'm going to look for someone else.
But what it sounds like to me is that these fees are a huge, huge component of their revenues.
But up to 8, well, yeah.
That's a significant component.
Yeah, especially because, you know, that's not all. Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point. It's significant. I mean, that's a significant amount. The fact that it's up to 8% suggests, yeah, it could be less. They might be
Well, they might be able to pass on a bit more.
They could be able to pass on a bit more. And to be honest, I think that as a policy, it might just take some of the worst parts out of the market in terms of the more extortionate. And not all letting agents are like this. Not all landlords are extortionate.
And also, the fee could be worth it. I mean, you know, people pay... the landlords might choose to pay the fee. The fee might stay the same at Belvoir because their service is fantastic.
And that's something that Jonas Crosland, our property correspondent, has made that point, is that, you know, a lot of owners of letting properties are not bothered. They have gone through a stamp duty rise. They might have gone through a tax relief change. And now this is just another thing. Yeah, it might slightly impact, but they're comparing the yield that they get on owning that property to a government bond yield or what another kind of fixed income alternative investment, and saying, oh, fair enough, I'll just let the person that manages the lettings deal with that. Yeah, I get a bit more of a charge. But you couldn't blame them for saying, well, I'll just factor that into my income return.
Still money not going into their pockets.
Yeah, exactly.
Still makes buy-to-let as an asset class a little bit less attractive
and
than
it's
it was
still,
before.
And the argument against it is still that it disincentivises people to invest in property, and we need more rental properties because we have more people needing somewhere to live.
So what are these fees actually for? I don't know. What are they actually for?
Things like checking references and
well, it should be the
inventory fees and that sort of thing.
So you have to pay to get your own references checked?
Yes.
That's brilliant. That's amazing. What about the household inventory that you're paying for them to make sure you haven't nicked anything as well?
Yes,
brilliant. It is extraordinary.
It is.
I mean, funny enough, these. I remember we talked about before how Foxtons, for example, had been suffering because of a fall in transaction volumes in the UK, and we'd always seen the lettings business as a useful counterbalance to perhaps weakening transaction volumes. Not so anymore.
Exactly right. And Countrywide, another estate agency, came out with a slight profit warning today saying that transaction volumes are lower, as you've said, but also in 2017 they might be even lower than in 2016. So that the ability of the letting agencies to bail out the estate agencies is a bit tougher than had been expected. And if you look at growth businesses like Purple Bricks, the hybrid estate agency,
yeah, why did they get dragged into this? Because
they have a nascent lettings business,
right.
But that is also a big part of their growth, and they make that argument that the letting agency business provides you with liquidity at a time when transaction volumes are down in the estate agency. So I suppose the analyst must be looking at the proposed growth of Purple Bricks and saying, okay, well, it's a bit tougher on the letting agency, but at the same time, they're a low-cost operator, and you just wonder whether these kind of changes, what they'll do is take out some of the, you know, more extreme, as we're saying, charges within the market, and then maybe, you know, an operator like the Purple Bricks, like the Zopa and the other low-cost operators might be seen as landlords as even more the kind of business they want to go with to keep the fees down.
I remember there was a lot of scepticism about the Purple Bricks model when they floated, and we wrote about it. I think Jonas before it actually floated, Jonas Crossan kind of previewed that business coming to market with a Property Matters column, and he got some abuse on the website because I think a lot of people just saw it as just another property fly by night. But I see a lot of Purple Brick signs popping up.
Yeah, exactly. And they're growing market share, and we've seen that in the data. I actually also, to fess up, wrote a column saying reasons not to buy into Purple Brick's growth
model. Did you, Ian?
I did. We had Purple Brick's on a buy at that point, and Jonas has very much, that's borne out his prediction. There are questions with Purple Brick's as to the model that they have in terms of the conversion rate is the big question, right? They have a conversion rate of the amount of instructions they get to sales, but the conversion rate is based on sales agreed subject to contract. And as anyone knows that sells a house, that's not the end of the story. So one of the questions with them is, are they helping people in their low cost model get from that point of sales subject to contract all the way through to completion? and we don't see the completion rate, the proper completion rate. So there are worries with Purple Bricks. Is that they're growing incredibly fast. Yeah, they're gaining market share. They've got a very interesting and compelling business model. But I'd like to see a couple of years down the line, when we see the customer service come through, whether people are saying, okay, and they really helped me out in that very important final third.
Yeah, I mean, my family has just sold a property, and we use the traditionalist agent paying the full, you know, the 1% of a reasonably large number, which seems like a lot of money considering the amount of work they do. But then you don't really understand the amount of work they do. You know, it was a bit of a difficult transaction.
And they have an aligned incentive. That's the other major difference with you. They want to sell the house for more because they get a greater proportion because it's a percentage charge. With Purple Bricks and the other kind of hybrids where they will take a fixed fee, the problem is that they might be incentivized to just get a sale done.
Get the money in, walk away, and when there's work
to be
done.
And I've seen with one of their competitors a case study on their website. Oh, it's brilliant. I had a valuation. I had one visit and the house sold. And for me, that makes me think, did they slightly undervalue that house because you had one viewing and the house sold?
It's the quickest way to sell a house.
Were they in a hurry to sell? So there are questions. There's also the fact they have these local property. Just to go through all the bare points, and I think there are a lot of bull points too. They also have these local property experts, region by region. Do they have the expertise of your local estate agency? But I have to say, I think that people are increasingly moving to these fixed fee models. People don't want to pay huge commission anymore for certain things. And we see that in the investment industry when it comes to investment advice. People are moving away from wanting to pay huge commissions for things. So I think they are definitely in a growth trend. Whether they are doing right by their clients and they are getting the kind of conversion to actual completed sales, I think we don't quite know yet. But yeah, I've been proved wrong on that so far. So
yeah. Tricky one to assess. What else you got, Bradley?
I guess we're sticking with the autumn statement stuff. We've got a couple of pages of news coverage, and there's a lot on the website as well for people listening who want a bit more than we're able to sort of get across in the podcast. But Chris Diller has done a great piece on sort of the more economic-y aspects of the autumn statement and the sort of impact of, while we're borrowing more, actually there's an interesting sort of which he points out, that actually debt to GDP is going to peak at 90.2% but then start falling even though we are borrowing more, because you've got this sort of negative yields but positive GDP growth. So as long as we don't go and borrow even more than the more we are borrowing, or we don't have a recession, then actually the ratio of debt to GDP will start to come down in about 4 to 5 years time, which is quite an interesting point Chris raises. And smaller things, I suppose, there was a new NSNI bond which was launched, which for savers they might be happy about, although the reaction from the industry was pretty lukewarm.
Muted?
Really. Yes.
£3,000 limit.
And also only 2.2%.
So 2.2% is fine. A 3,000 limit is pathetic.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe it's because with the pensioner bond, which is a similar iteration, the website of NSNI crashed. So maybe the government was actively trying to disincentivize too much interest there.
Yeah, seriously, it doesn't touch the sides of the problem that most people have with where to put their money.
Exactly. And another, I guess, slightly related point to that, on sort of putting money in investment and pensions, there was this really nicely named money purchase annual allowance.
I'm asleep already.
I know, but bear with me. I'll do my best to put this in a nutshell. Effectively, if you turn 55 and started drawing down a pension, you're able to put money back into that pension, and £10,000 worth was tax-free. The government is proposing to reduce that to £4,000, and that actually could be quite a problem for asset managers who are looking to rely more on drawdown products, because what this potentially will do, and it is a consultation, but if this does go ahead, it will obviously prevent people from drawing down some money and thinking, oh, actually, I might want to put some more back into my pension, which would then obviously be run more than likely by an asset manager. So it's a dull, dry piece of legislation, arguably, but it could be quite important, actually. So
yeah, I know Steve Webb, the old pensions minister, seems to have a new job, and he's not happy about this.
He's not happy about it, no, he's not.
No.
Because obviously, apart from the being bad for asset managers, it's not great for life insurance companies that offer drawdown products, right? And we're still finding out what are the common practices of people post Pensions Freedom Day, aren't we? And the assumption prior to that was that income drawdown would be a really big area where people would want a bit of income, they maybe want to save a bit more, but any changes that make those ideas less viable and encourage people to maybe just take it all out, stick it in a buy-to-let property or stick it in a savings fund.
I think so. Do you know what? I honestly think the more I think about this, I think most people want some kind of certainty in what they're going to be getting in retirement. And actually, I think annuities are probably what most people would actually choose, were annuity rates half decent.
When you survey anyone about actually what they want out of retirement, if you don't mention the word annuity, the thing they describe is an annuity.
Indeed. Of course they do. No, I love the idea of drawdown. Of course I do. I'm the editor of the Investors Chronicle. But I tell you what, it's easier in theory than it is in practice to make drawdown work as an individual investor. We see this problem all the time in our reader portfolios. How do I make this pot of money I have last through retirement?
The key word, last.
How much do I need to grow it by to make sure that if I live to 90, it's still going to be supporting me? You know, it's just not a simple problem. And I, you know, whilst I love the idea of pension freedoms too, I really don't think they thought about it well enough. Sorry, Steve Webb, you were involved in this. And I don't think that the appropriate amount of work went into making this market work, especially if you wanted to create this drawdown driven investment culture.
Exactly. I mean, and I think I saw it very much at the time as being a very conservative individualist policy of letting people have access to their retirement savings. Steve Webb, as the Lib Democrat pensions minister at the time, was very much, no, this, I was a part of this decision and I believe in this. And you wonder over time whether he might have cause to say, well, I don't think that was the best thing for retirement security that policy was actually taken.
No. Agreed. Okay, that's enough Autumn statement. Lots more on the website, isn't there?
There is, yeah.
It was a fairly dry event, but actually some interesting subtleties in there, which I think are worth digging into. Some of the house building stuff as well, which we're not going to talk about now, because we talk about house builders far too much. Should we talk about Black Friday? Does anyone care about Black Friday anymore?
Well,
it's a retail thing.
People do. I mean, yeah, Black Friday is basically a sort of a day of sort of potentially deep discounting by retailers to entice.
Is it actually Friday or is it today?
No, it's tomorrow. It's tomorrow, Friday.
All right.
It is on Friday.
I know Friday's tomorrow, but so, I just don't know. You can never quite tell with the retail industry when they're going to start these things.
I think the concept has a bit of elasticity, let's say that, since it started.
Okay.
It was, to sort of briefly go through Harriet's article, the history of it is that it was the day after Thanksgiving, which is today. It was kind of like a Boxing Day, but in the US, basically. So like in Christmas Day here, after we have Boxing Day, and there are often lots of sales on Boxing Day, the US kind of started this Black Friday thing. And of course, it's, you know, interconnected world as we are. It's become a British phenomenon, and I'm sure a European and more widely around the world as well. So it's effectively retailers incentivizing some early Christmas shopping.
Right.
But I guess the problem is, and the point that one of the analysts that Harry quotes in the piece, is that it's quite a strange concept, really, because arguably what you're doing is you're setting a low, low price at the start of the point where you're going to have arguably most customers through your door, because it's Christmas is coming up. So then you spend the run-up to Christmas almost trying to maybe incrementally raise prices from this Black Friday low. So it is a bit of a curious concept.
But I kind of get that, because I would suggest, not being a retail expert myself, i.e. running a shop, but, you know, I would suggest the later you left your Christmas shopping, the more you should pay.
It's like punishment.
Oh yeah.
And who does the Christmas shopping in your house?
Is that like the
I've done half of it already.
that's like the Uber economics Christmas.
But it is. Of course it is. If you go out Christmas Eve, don't expect a bargain.
So you're
a panic shopper.
So I should go
pay more.
I should go on January the 2nd and say, can I have my Christmas present a lot cheaper, please?
Yeah, well, you can do that, but you've got to square that with your family first.
We had an interesting comment earlier from one of our writers when Bradley was talking about Black Friday, and she said, well, you can just wait until the January sales and you get all the same sales. That does stop you getting them as Christmas presents.
Yeah, homemade Christmas presents. Anyway, yeah, Black Friday, pass me by. Passes me by every year. I would be one of those generally penalised rather hard for leaving much of my Christmas shopping too late.
Yeah. I mean, the essence of Harriet's article anyway, to come back to it, I suppose, is that it's in the UK, it's very much become an online phenomenon. And although it's sort of meant to induce kind of a flocking of people to the actual physical store estates, what was kind of seen last year was a lot of online buying, and that's kind of expected to be the case this time as well.
Is the imported inflation going to be a bit of a drag on it this year? Because I suppose companies like Apple have said, this is how much more an Apple Mac now costs. I mean, they've been pretty clear about it. And there's a limit to how much retailers can discount.
You're right, there will be a limit. I guess it depends on a company by company basis. It will obviously depend when they ordered things, and the chances are they probably didn't order it before the pound fell as much as it did post the EU referendum vote. But there probably will be an element of that, yeah. And I guess once it's passed, we'll have a bit of a better idea comparatively about how much discounting there was, the popularity of it, which therefore might indicate how much discounting there was. But yeah, I guess until we're past the event and people start really analysing it, it is kind of difficult to say how much any price inflation will be baked into Black Friday discounts.
Well, at least if it's online only, people can't be having punch-ups in the shops over cheap TV.
Well, it's not online only, but it's become in the UK more an online phenomenon because Asda actually pulled out of it after that. That's what you're referring to, basically. That incident of, like, the TV fight, basically. So there are some shops who've actually actively pulled away from it altogether, online and in physical
form. It is a
form.
Bit grubby, isn't it, really?
I mean, it doesn't entice me to the shops. It makes me think I wouldn't want to go anywhere near them. Too many people.
I don't really want to go near shops at the best of times, but there you go. Oh, okay. And actually, I mean, on that note, let's briefly go back to Amazon, because not being one to go to shops, if I can avoid them, Amazon is obviously a first port of call. This is the cover feature. We talk about it a lot in terms of actually what it's doing. Not this week. We talk about Amazon a lot because it's just everywhere. Its tentacles are everywhere, certainly in retail. Always comes up. But actually, I guess the crux of this feature is that it's extending into lots of other areas that you perhaps wouldn't expect. And there are many companies that you may own that may have their lunch eaten by the encroachment of Amazon, as it were.
Amazon risk.
Amazon risk.
No, I completely agree, and there's some really interesting comment in that. I think on a wider point around Amazon, I do find it quite interesting. They've had Donald Trump, the US president-elect, has been quite clear on the campaign trail that he has a problem with Amazon. Partly that's its ownership of the Washington Post, which I think has been critical of him and his candidacy. But what's been quite interesting, he has actually talked about antitrust in terms of Amazon. His main gripe seems to be about the proportion of tax that they pay, which obviously is the common gripe to many governments. But he has also kind of raised the question of antitrust in relation to them and the impact that they've had on department stores up and down the US.
He's right.
He is undoubtedly right. And you wonder whether one of the bigger risks to Amazon is that people get more in tune with this question. It's something I've been researching a bit, this question of vertical consolidation. It's the idea that you don't have huge concentration in any particular sector, but a massive multinational will go into lots of different sectors and have quite a big impact on the players within those industries. So you wonder, the sovereign backlash, which you've had in some regions against Amazon already, how far that might have to play. It might just be that there was a lot of rhetoric from Mr. Trump ahead of the election around Amazon. He doesn't really want to do anything about it, but he has been quite explicit about some of the problematic sides to the company and its impact on domestic retailers.
I can understand that. I mean, there's a couple of things that come up here. One, you don't pay tax on revenue, right? Full stop. And Amazon, a lot of its profit goes back into building up its business to be even bigger. So it's not making the huge profits that you might expect it to, given its dominance, because it's ploughing a lot of that back into the business.
But governments are changing. One of the things in the autumn statement was Philip Hammond saying that we no longer want companies that are, you know, making a huge amount of revenue being able to kind of pay less tax because they've carried tax allowances from previous years. They are tinkering with that. So that, as a basic, which I agree with you.
But that kind of goes against some of also what he was saying about innovation, which is that if you don't allow companies to invest the revenues they make in loss-making enterprises, to invest the cash that they are, or the profits, small profits they might be earning back in, you are essentially discouraging companies that might grow to be very large from investing and innovating.
Exactly right. Yeah, no, I think this is why
a huge quandary.
Yeah, there's a huge quandary. It's a big part of economic policy. You know, how do you promote growth? And you even have the government saying we are going to fund research and development. A lot of stuff.
That is ridiculous.
Which is, you know, why aren't companies then investing in this stuff?
If the government can identify areas for research and development that businesses can't, I would be absolutely gobsmacked. I mean, the UK has tried this in the past. We had something that I'm looking at on my call to make called the National Enterprise Board in the 1960s and 70s, which was the brainchild of Harold Wilson, which was supposed to invest in small innovative startups in the UK to really fire our tech industry forward. I say tech, it was low tech, as we might understand it today, high tech at the time. Most of the money, as I understand it, for the National Enterprise Board ultimately invested went into British Leyland, propping up a failing car manufacturer. Governments are rubbish at investing in innovation.
That's why people are worried about a more interventionist government. But they obviously feel there are areas, and we've written about this previously, where they can help prop up R&D.
I would suggest that it's the job of government to create a fertile field in which innovative companies can grow. And you do that by having good R&D tax credits policy, not by directing money into particular areas. But that's just my view. The other thing I would say about Amazon is, we live in a free market. And if people want to shop on Amazon rather than going to Debenhams or Next or Macy's or whatever it might be, well, that's the market.
We don't
live
in a completely free market.
Come on.
We don't live in a free market for broadband.
Okay, we're not talking about broadband.
Yeah,
we're talking about goods. I can go and buy goods in Dixons or I can order them online at Amazon. And if Amazon makes life better for me, the shopping experience is better, I'm going to go to Amazon. Now, and that's the market working.
That is the market working as it stands, but we have, and that's partially why we have the dominance of certain multinational companies that can play the tax landscape pretty effectively to grow in the areas and to charge their profits in the areas where they'll have the least tax spend. And national governments on both sides of the Atlantic are getting more and more uncomfortable with that status quo. So the only thing I'm suggesting is, maybe we shouldn't expect that to be the status quo forward.
So we have identified a number of companies that we feel are somewhat at risk from Amazon and its encroachment into their areas. Royal Mail, for example, being one of them. You know, I got my first Amazon parcel delivered on a Sunday the other day because I've been completely by surprise. Royal Mail don't deliver on Sunday. That's brilliant. Amazon, all over. Yes, please. Thank you. Amazon.
Yeah, definitely. And the parcels business is one that must have burned so many private investors over the past decade or so. I was looking at the history of DX Group, which was used to be listed, bought by a private equity company, had problems, bought by a private equity company, came back onto the market, has had the same exact problems, but was just in a bit of a worse state on the balance sheet, but people kept buying back in, and the same competitive pressures. So, yeah, I mean, it's the same problems. And Royal Mail, obviously on the letters business, still has that obligation to provide letters to all around the country.
Yep, which is unfortunate, but that's where it is.
That's where it is, but that's another example of where, you know, Amazon can undercut them on a higher margin part of the business, as we know that's what parcels are.
Ocado. This is interesting. We talked about this very briefly last week in respect to the Morrison deal, but yeah, I mean, you've got to be excuse the French, crap in your pants.
Or worried, as an Ocado customer might say. Yeah, you're right.
Worried. Frightfully nervous.
Yes. As you said, we did discuss this last week. And it just seems that Morrison's and Amazon, which have recently done a tie-up, that is a problem for Ocado.
Yeah. Yeah. No. I think this is fascinating. You know, I really do. I mean, it sounds like, and we didn't really go into this whole regulatory backdrop that you've alluded to. So maybe the risk will take longer to play out than we kind of suggest. And if indeed it ever does, if governments kind of block the ever seemingly endless expansion of Amazon.
Yeah, and where I agree with you, and just to kind of balance what I was saying before, is that this is, I agree with you that this is a very competitive market, and with Amazon getting into the food delivery market, having its Amazon Fresh, partnering with Morrisons, Morrisons partnering with Ocado, but there's lots of other players, traditional grocers, who have huge market shares when it comes to bricks and mortar sales of food. This is, you know, what a lot of people would say is capitalism in action.
Absolutely.
It's capital going to the areas where it can be best deployed. So the worry for Ocado is they deployed a lot of that early capital and now everyone else is catching up.
That's true. Some people have gone. HMV, we've talked about them before. You know, HMV, you know, there was nothing to stop HMV becoming a very good online retailer of music, video, developing a streaming service, doing everything that Amazon has done in music and film, but it didn't. And that is that.
And I guess now you've got things like Spotify, which is trying to be a competitor to what Amazon's trying to do with streaming music, and obviously Apple. So as you say, these things can be developed. You know, something like HMV could have been a Spotify, quite arguably, if the right people and the right minds were there.
Yeah, that's the big question, isn't it? The right people, the right minds. And I think this is a perennial question with the some of the management that we see are paid enormous sums of money for managing businesses very badly. I say Amazon have a great manager. I'd say HMV perhaps over the years did not. There you go. Should we, before we run out of time, touch on a couple of results? We've got lots in this week's issue. We've been rambling today. In a constructive manner.
Constructive rambling. Only things to highlight, I suppose. There's lots in there, so do have a look. But CYBG, the Challenger Bank, which hasn't been listed for too long, has turned its first pre-tax profit in 5 years. Its kind of cost reduction is going well, so that's one to look at in the Challenger Bank space, which is an interesting space a lot of people paying attention to.
Yeah, I've been looking at Challenger Banks myself as a customer, potentially. I'm intrigued.
Yeah, exactly.
Metro, I've been looking at. It's nice.
I mean,
nice.
It's picking between them.
It's not usually how you describe it. Actually, it is nice. How you might describe Metro, isn't it? I mean, this is it's the experience.
It's fun.
The experience,
I think they try and make it fun. It's a store rather than a branch. I mean, the question is, in an area of low interest rates, we can't really much difference between any savings account. Who's providing you the better experience as a customer?
Who's feeding my dog?
Who's feeding your dog? Who's letting your children count money? I don't know.
Yeah.
Money lenders. But
it isn't as random as it sounds, is it, Ian?
Because no, there is a magic money counting
machine.
No,
not that bit. Money counting, I think, is fairly standard in banks. Feeding dogs is not.
Yeah, well, not many banks, no other banks have a magic money counting machine that you can guess. I mean, it's literally, they can guess how much money they've put in a thing and then...
Really? Comes up.
Yeah, there's a little booth. I mean, it's not a normal... You go into one of these stores, it's not a normal branch.
Indeed. I've not been in one yet. I've seen it taking shape. I'm about
and just
to
finally, honest. In terms of other results, there's a couple of interesting ones about imported inflation as a result of Brexit, and one that actually Bradley reported on Victoria. So, for example, AI World, is the white goods online company, has said there was some pressure from suppliers on margins, which you could expect for someone kind of importing goods from outside of the UK. Victoria makes its carpets within the UK and has actually benefited vis-a-vis its rivals as a result.
Yeah, I mean, they're saying that their cost inflation will be less than that of rivals, because often a lot of carpet is imported from Europe, whereas they make a lot more of theirs in the UK.
Fascinating. I need some new carpet. I'll be checking out who stocks Victoria Carpets. And on that note, we have overrun. Thank you, Bradley. Thank you, Ian. Lots and lots more of the mag. I mean, ludicrous amounts of results this week. It's been very, very busy. Wealth management is the subject of the stock screen. Again, another fascinating area in light of the difficulties private investors are having actually finding a good home for their money. Algie Hall has once again delivered the goods on the stock screen front. Seven high yield small caps for lasting income. Again, the story of the search for yield. Lots in the personal finance and funds section, including a good analysis of the FCA's report on fund management fees, which I also discuss in my editorial. The usual tips, lots of comment, as I say, lots more news, including lots more news on the website relating to the Altman's name. So thank you very much for listening. Thank you, everybody. The Amazon Risk, 4.70, all good news agents, or get online, subscribe. See you soon. Bye-bye.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage.
Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.